Oh, new questions, but from the same old people. Answered by the same old monk. Here we go. Is it necessary to be a vegetarian to gain full benefit of a meditation? What about a small drink once a week? I mean, a glass of wine. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, you've got to be kind. It's just a small bit of alcohol once a week, a small bit of murder once a week, a small bit of adultery once a week. It's only a tiny bit of adultery, so just come on, you've got to... So they always, when it's a small bit, they always refer to the fifth precept, just a tiny bit of alcohol. So just a tiny bit of killing. A tiny bit of adultery. No, come on. You don't need a glass of wine. No, because you can have non-alcoholic wines. You can have non-alcoholic beer. So it's amazing what you can have these days. So actually it's not necessary. Why do one have wine for anyway? You know why they call it wine? Because when you take it, you start whining. So it makes you sort of negative. That's where the word wine, you know, to whine, to complain, comes from people who drink too much wine. That's what I say anyway. And actually, the Katina ceremony we had last week? About a week ago. It's a week and a half ago. Just one of the, we had lots of fun. Those of you who were here, it's a very joyous day. People were laughing, having a great time. And the people who cleaned up, you know, there's so much rubbish afterwards, and we can't put all the rubbish in the bins. So what we have to do, to be able to take it to the tip, we have to sort it first of all. Take all the recycling stuff out and just, the messy stuff to take to the recycling place. And when they were, emptying all the bags, just really mucky. They took all the water bottles out, all the tin cans out, and all the paper out, and the paper plates and the cardboard out to separate it all so it can be recycled. So a couple of monks volunteered for that. You know, it was many hours' work. You weren't doing that as well, weren't you, Chunda? No, you weren't. Okay, Chairman. Now he's going to do it next year. But one of the novices doing that, they told me that sort of they did all of that work and they didn't find one can of beer. Yeah, so there's no, all these 2,000 people who were here for that Katina ceremony, and there's not one can of beer, no wine, no alcohol, and they had such a wonderful time. Isn't that amazing? And anyway, people find that actually wine is not good for your health, it's actually bad for your health. So a couple of years ago, someone looked at the survey, looked at the statistics, which were done in California. Did I tell the story already? Singapore group. Oh, Singapore group, okay. So they looked at the statistics again. I think the original study was done maybe 8, 9, 10 years ago, and they did survey a lot of people in the state of California, and to check whether they took alcohol or not, and to check the health of their heart, their cardiovascular disease or lack of it. And the first survey showed a very clear statistical connection between people who drank red wine and who had better cardiac health. And that got in newspapers and everyone said, yes, red wine is good for your health. But some very clever fellow had a look at the statistics again. And he now separated people according to their economic status, their income levels. Because what he suspected, the sort of people who can afford to drink red wine are usually of a higher income bracket. And so when he factored in your income bracket, just check people of a certain income bracket, of those income bracket, those who drank red wine and those who didn't, who had a better health. And as the ones who didn't drink red wine had a better health. The only reason why it seemed to indicate that red wine was good for your health was only because, not the red wine, but the sort of people who drink red wine have a higher income and therefore have the better health. It was the income level created a better wealth, not the drinking of red wine. It was just that those people had a high income. Most of them also drank red wine. And that's actually why it's now that whole research has been overthrown, and now they know that drinking alcohol, all types, is actually bad for your health. So there's no excuse anymore. You've got to be very careful with some of these surveys, and one I always mention was the tobacco companies many years ago. They actually did some research and they showed a very positive correlation between smoking cigarettes and not getting Alzheimer's, not getting dementia. And they trumpeted, if you smoke cigarettes, they don't know why this happened, they said, but it means you've got significantly less chance of getting Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And you all know how horrible that is to get dementia. So they're hoping to increase the sales of tobacco because it prevents dementia. Until somebody pointed out, yes, it is true. Smoking cigarettes decreases the incidence of dementia for the reason that you don't live long enough to get dementia. That was the reason why. So you've got to be very careful. The only reason why red wine was supposed to be good for your health, because those who can afford red wine could afford better health care. It was the income, not the wine, which was creating better health. So you don't need to take red wine or anything. I mean, as far as a vegetarian, if you can be a vegetarian, great. If you can't, I've told you that I used to be a vegetarian before I became a monk, but when you become a monk, you're supposed to eat whatever you're given. And I was given frogs and snails and goodness knows what else. And the snails were just rubbish. It's like eating an eraser. It was disgusting stuff. If effective meditation is about letting go, is it okay to use meditation time for sometimes reflecting on and investigating our character? Or will those aspects of our character that require cultivation and improvement become apparent to us as a flash of inspiration at some point when we are letting go? Reflecting, investigating our character. Sometimes it's just so hard to actually investigate your character. Because I remember a very interesting thing I did when I was second year as a monk, after the Range Retreat. There's only two Western monks in this monastery. And so afterwards we decided to tell each other what we thought of each other in a positive way. And it was amazing what I thought he thought of me, he didn't think of me at all. So how I came across, or how I thought I came across, was totally different than what he saw. And what he thought I thought of him was totally different as well. And so sometimes our character, how can you judge your own character? Even now, sometimes people say, I'm a very negative character. I say, no, you're not, you're very positive. Even today, just at tea time, I went over to the monastery, I said, I'm very lazy. He said, you lazy, you work so hard. So my understanding of my own character is I'm lazy. And other people say, you're not lazy, you work hard. So which is the right one? I don't know. My idea of my character is I tell very brilliant jokes. That's what I think. So when I investigate my character, well, these jokes are really, really funny. But if you tell me why, you've got a totally different idea of my character. So this is not to try and investigate this, because your character is just like a chameleon. It's always changing. It's a shimmer. It's a phantom. You haven't got any character. So it's best not to examine it and just let it all go. That's what I would do anyway. So Ajahn, you said that we create our own heaven and hell. Would you also say we create our human realm? If so, can you expand on the difference between us and creator beings, God? Are we just limited in creating our own world as opposed to creating other beings' world as well? And do we create some of it? And these beings create other parts of our existence? Okay, that in this world, because there's many people creating things all the time, so we've only got a little bit of leeway to create this human realm, but there's a lot of stuff we can create. When we get very, very negative, if we say we give up on global warming, and then we're creating a problem. It's amazing what we can do as together if we've got this communal will. There's no end of things we can't solve and create. So, in even a physical sense, we can create a great world to live in. But the most important thing which we create, is our mental world. And most of you live in a mental world much more than a physical world. So you live, not the world, it's not the world, it's not the sunset you see, it's the words, what a beautiful sunset. And most of us live in that mental world so much that we are creating a huge amount of our world in the human realm, even though we've got a physical stuff which makes it harder to have full freedom to create. But nevertheless, it's amazing just how much you create. Even in this retreat, you create a beautiful retreat, or this retreat sucks. I'm a beautiful meditator. It's just the same. My character, I can create my character. I tell wonderful jokes. You can create this terrible character, those stupid jokes. So, what are you going to create? I understand you've got so much freedom to create a world. You might as well create a beautiful one. Why not? So sometimes, you know, psychologists, they give people pieces of paper and just colour it in. And some people just, they use these very dull and pastel colours. Other people use beautiful, bright colours. Some people at the end of a talk say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Some say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. See, we all say sadhus, but I've created these very happy sadhus, these extreme sadhus. So that's how much you can create in this world. And you can create a huge amount of happiness, no matter what you have to deal with in life. And these other realms which aren't so physical, which are mind-created, you've got a huge amount of leeway there. So you are the gods. You know, that's, your husband always said he was a god. Actually, he was right. He acted like that. And so did you. So each one of us are the creators in a sense. We are owners of our karma, heirs of our karma, creators of our karma. So, don't blame some big god in the sky. It's all up to you to do things, to create. So that's what I like. The creator is you. So you can actually create a huge amount. You can create problems or you can create happiness. And I know that I've always been a positive being. I always remember this story that years and years and years ago I was visiting England and Ajahn Sumedho took me up north and we went to do a retreat in this town called Doncaster. It was an old, worn out coal mining town. And when we arrived, sort of on the weekend, everyone said, look, this is really weird. Because this is the sort of town which people leave on the weekend. Nobody comes there for the weekend. So it's like an old industrial town which was pretty run down. So on the Saturday morning we went for a walk. And we went for a walk to the park and see the flowers and a beautiful little monument somewhere. And when we came back, they asked, where did you go for a walk? I went for a walk to the beautiful park, all these wonderful flowers. And our host said, oh, yeah, that's typical of you two, you're very positive people. And a few weeks before this monk came, he went to the gasworks. So he went to a walk down the industrial run-down part of town, because that's what he was like. Sort of, you know, a depressive, negative person. So you can always tell, you know, even on this retreat, where you go for a walk. If you go for a walk down to the sewage system, down the bottom there, that shows you've got a problem. If you go down where the gardens are planted and the beautiful birds are singing, then you've got a good chance to meditate. So you create your walk. So you can create a lot of things. Here we go. How long do you think you'll live for? Now think, what do they mean by this? Let's see what the rest of the question. I suspect something very fishy in this question. When I see stories of arahants in the sutras relinquish their life force and go in flames, I wonder when you'll go. Of course we don't want you to go. We will at least have you for 10 more years. Only 10? You just don't like me? We've had 10 more years of bad jokes and that's enough. Now, I'm afraid that's something which we can't do here in Australia, to sort of go in flames, because it's the fire season now and you need a permit to go up in flames. But actually, that was actually a really cool way which, you know, many of the arahats committed suicide. Okay, I'm going to put it that way because this is very interesting, because Ananda did this, Dabba did this, a few other people did this. That when it came time to the end of their life, you know, instead of just dying like ordinary people, they did it with some style. So with Ananda, I mean, he was, you know, the most famous monk at that time. And everybody wanted to get these monks' relics. Like even now, I mean, if like a famous monk in Thailand dies, they fight over relics. And so Ananda was about to die and had his two, you know, big kingdoms wanted him to die in their place. If they died in, if he died in their country, they can have the relics there, and there'd be lots of tourists. It'd be good for business. And you know that is exactly what happened with St. Francis of Assisi. When he was about to die, he was being followed, and people invited him, "Please, please, please, come and visit my sort of little principality," because they knew if he died there, that's where his relics would be, and that was really big business, you know, to get visitors. And one of the other stories of relics I remember was this Bishop of Norwich in England. Norwich, you know, didn't have much going for it at that time, but he went on a pilgrimage to Europe to one of these saints. And, you know, they had them in the coffins, but once a year on that saint's day, they opened up the coffin so people could actually worship that deceased corpse of a saint, and people would actually kiss that dead body. It was really, really gross. And that was supposed to be good luck, you know, auspicious. And so this Bishop of Norwich, when he was visiting this city somewhere in France, or Italy or somewhere, he didn't just kiss sort of this deceased corpse, he actually bit off the nose. He bit off this nose of the dead corpse and kept it in his mouth. And that's the only way he could smuggle it out. And he took it all the way back to Norwich, enshrined it in the cathedral, and because of that, he had a relic of a saint, the nose of Saint whatever it was. And all these tourists came to Norwich, and all the hotels and the restaurants were all full, and he became so famous as a result of that. And that was just a gross story. That's what relics were like in those times. So because of that, that Ananda, you know, was being followed by these two people just wanting his relics. And so, what he did, he got to the river dividing the two kingdoms. And he rose up into the air, levitated. And he entered the fire element, which means he immolated his own body. And he made a determination, and it worked. His ashes fell on either side of the river in perfectly equal pile, so that both the kingdoms could have some ashes. And that was the story. And actually, that was many monks did that. They rose up into the air and entered the fire element. And that was a brilliant way of going. You know, go out sort of in a big fireball. And that's a very, very neat way of going about things. But unfortunately, because of fire restrictions in Western Australia, we just can't do that these days. We don't want to start a bushfire. But if anyone knows ancient Greek, I always get very interested in just how much Buddhism went into Europe. And I think in the 2nd or 3rd century BC, there was a Buddhist called Samano Chagas. Samana means samana, you know, like monk. And Chagas, it's very hard to know exactly what that meant. Maybe it was Chaga, which is renunciation. But he created a sensation in the Forum of Athens by jumping onto a funeral pyre, they said, and immolating himself. Now, I don't know what the translation is, but sometimes I was thinking, was that another monk who just rose into the air and immolated himself? Because this was actually causing a huge sensation in ancient Athens. So if anyone knows ancient Greek, it would be great to actually get a real translation, see whether it really is one of these examples which were recorded in, it was a Buddhist monk in Athens about 2 or 3 centuries BC. And Samano Chagas was his name. And I'd only got English translations, but you never know, that could have been a similar case of someone rising up into the air and entering the fire element. Very cool way to go, or a hot way to go. Dear Ajahn, does 1st, 2nd, 3rd and 4th jhana always precede the immaterial states? Why is it called immaterial states? As far as I know, that's the only way you can get into the immaterial states. You have to go 1st, 2nd, 3rd and 4th. Because the 2nd jhana is within the 1st one. The 3rd is within the 2nd. You know, you can't sort of suddenly go into a third jhana, you've got to go through the first, second, third, because this is a stilling of the mind. And the fourth is in the third jhana, and the first immaterial is in the fourth, is in the middle of it. It's a special case of the fourth jhana. And the next immaterial is inside the first immaterial. It just, as things disappear and vanish, then you go to the next stage. So yeah, they are based on those four jhanas. And why they're called immaterial states is this is because they're made of just perception, nothing else. It's just the mind is starting to disappear and the only thing left is your perception. It's just a way of seeing, but basically it's just so ephemeral. There's nothing really solid there. It's just basically a concept, but a very fine concept, which is all you're aware of. So your mind is vanishing, it's becoming so thin and gossamer, there's hardly anything left. So these incredibly refined states. It's just when things are disappearing. Are the states called nothingness and neither possession or non-perception taught by Lara Kalama Ramaputta, teachers to the Buddha before his enlightenment, similar to the immaterial states? Now this is that sort of question which I've dealt with before, that the Bodhisattva, the Buddha before he was enlightened, he had the two teachers, Uddaka Ramaputta and Alaraka Lama. And according to the legend, Alaraka Lama was supposed to be teaching the state of nothingness, which according to the text the Buddha achieved. He had the same attainment as his teacher, and the teacher invited him to, to be a co-teacher. But he said, no, this was not getting him anywhere. It wasn't getting him anywhere. It wasn't a condition for enlightenment. So he went to Uddaka Ramaputta, and this was Uddaka Ramaputta was a disciple of this Rama. So Buddha got to the stage of neither perception nor non-perception. That's what they said, and that was the stage of Uddaka's teacher. And so he said, you be our teacher from now on. But the Bodhisattva again said, this is not conducive to enlightenment. So he left and did his ascetic practices. And they didn't work either. And then just when he gave up those ascetic practices, only then he remembered the time as a boy under the rose apple tree. While his father was doing a ceremony, he sat under the tree and got into a first jhana. And he said, ah, now that might be the way to enlightenment. And the insight came up, yes, that jhana is the way to enlightenment. So he then realized you can't get into those jhanas with a very weak, emaciated, painful body. So why don't I sort of look after my body to eat, to bathe, to rest, just like I told you in the beginning of this retreat. And then with my body just feeling very good, then I can get into these jhanas, which he did under the Bodhi tree. And he became a Buddha. And the whole story is fascinating because he only remembered the jhanas under the rose apple tree. He did not recall any jhanas which were very more recent under Alaraka Lama Uddaka Ramaputta. The implication is very strong that he'd never attained any jhanas under Uddaka Ramaputta and Alaraka Lama. Otherwise he would have remembered the jhanas under them. So obviously it's very... It's almost certain that he never got jhanas under Alaraka Lama and Ramaputra. And because these states of nothingness and neither perception or non-perception are real ones, have to be based on jhanas, Alaraka Lama and Uddaka Ramaputra were not the real thing. Because the real thing elsewhere, the Buddha says, is conducive to enlightenment. These are states which you can use as a basis for enlightenment. So that's the only consistent explanation there, that what Alaraka Lama and Uddaka Ramaputta had the right name, but were not the real things. In just the same way, I was told that you can get actually a PhD these days for about $10 or $100, I think it is. All you need to do is to write to an American university and send your check, and you get a PhD by return of mail. But it's not worth very much. It's in name only. Because, you know, where there is an opportunity to make a few bucks, you know, that someone's in there selling these PhDs. Or even in my day, you know, what I had to do to get sort of a bachelor's, you know, is a BA. Cambridge, they don't have BSCs, it's all BAs no matter what you... no matter what subject you have. It's much harder than these days. Sometimes I see what you need to do to get a BA these days, and it's nowhere near as tough as in my day. And I'm sure that 30 days or 40 days earlier was much tougher. I still remember Goethe's. What's that fellow's name? Faust, Dr. Faustus. And you know, this was talking about the universities in Germany about, was it 200 or 300 years ago? And they would only issue one PhD maybe every 5 or 6 years. And you really had to be sort of a top-notch academic to get a PhD in those days. So a PhD is much easier these days. You know, we always tend to lower the standards. And that's nature. It's the same here, that just as these states, you do tend to lower the standards sometimes. I try and keep a very high standards for jhanas, as you all know, and that's why many people don't like my teachings. They'd rather go to another teaching, because you don't have to get so deep, and it's called first jhana. So you go, oh, very good. I prefer to go here, because I don't have to work so hard, and I get first jhana. Ajahn Brahm is just so tough. But the thing here, Lama Klama Uttakaramaputta, I think that what they were teaching was not the real thing. And that's the only thing which is consistent. Anyway, that's just a scholastic thing. That has nothing to do with what you're doing on this retreat. What is the difference between anatta caused by the... Something re-aused by the sotapanna and the conceit in the 10 fetters. It's really... realized. What is the difference between anatta realized by the sotapanna and the conceit in the 10 fetters? Okay, this is a good question. That a stream winner has seen there's no self. But even though you've seen there's no self, the view is there, yes, you know there's no self, still you have these old habits that you sometimes think in the terms of a self, or you sometimes perceive in the sense of a self, because the way your cognitive processes work, your view is fundamental. As you view, so you perceive and so you think. So if you view that Jesus is Lord and you're a Christian, you perceive that all the evidence is out there. You know, that how can you not believe in Jesus? Because once you have that view, anything which contradicts your view, like science, you know, that's a work of the devil. That's nothing to do with Jesus. But anything which supports it, now then, that must be Jesus. So actually, you do actually bend perception to fit your views. And from perception, that's where your thoughts come from. They justify your thoughts. It's the evidence on which your thoughts are based. But sometimes the evidence which we have is biased, because you know, we pick and choose what evidence we want based on our views. And so when you become a stream winner, your view gets purified. In the sense that, yeah, you realize there is no self. It's obvious. You can see it very clearly. You can see where your delusion was. But it takes a while for your perceptions and thoughts to come into line. Sometimes it takes 7 lifetimes. So you will still have some conceit. You still think in terms of a self. I'm better, I'm worse, I'm the same. Because you lose your mindfulness, you forget, basically. But afterwards, it's only a matter of time before non-self becomes not part of just of your views, but also the way you perceive and think. You just don't think in terms of self anymore. If you understand that, you understand something very deep. What is the consciousness in the arahat that ceased without remainder, that stopped them from taking rebirth? This is the difference from Puchachana, kindly enlightenment. It's the same consciousness. All consciousness is, you know, the same, the sixth sense consciousness, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and knowing. But for the enlightened one, they never think it comes from them, so they don't own it. It's basically the same consciousness, but the enlightened one realizes it's none of my business. So because it's none of my business, they can let it go. You know, many of you have come and told me your personal problems. But you know, it's none of my business. As soon as you go, I forget it. I don't so worry about all your personal problems. So I listen to you, and I give you the best advice, and as soon as you move out of that chair, it is gone. That's why Ajahn Chah used to teach us, if you're going to be a monk and you're going to be a counselor, you have to be like dustbin. You receive everybody's rubbish, you know, husbands, finances, health. What's that got to do with me? But I receive all of that, all the rubbish in my dustbin. But Ajahn Chah said, be a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. So as soon as you dump it in me, you dump on me, it goes straight through and out the other end, and I keep nothing. Now that's actually how we let go. So a consciousness which keeps nothing, that's the consciousness of an arahat. The consciousness which accumulates things is a consciousness of a putujana. You accumulate, what do you accumulate? Problems and suffering. The consciousness of an arahat, they let go of everything. So just always this empty. People have been hinting to me that if I eat meat, I will go to hell. Or Mahayanas would say my relatives will eat me in my next lifetime. Well, I eat fish and meat sometimes. And if they eat me next lifetime, I'm very fat, so they can get a really full meal. No. So that is just fear. Even the Buddha ate meat. And that's very, very clear in the suttas. It's one of the most obvious cases was when there was a robber and he'd actually stolen a cow with his mates and they slaughtered the cow and they're running into the forest, you know, to hide. And they passed this great bhikkhuni, Upalawana. She was meditating in the forest. And one of the robbers, even though they were thieves, they still had no faith in some of these great monks and nuns. So the chief of the robbers, you know, he made sure that the rest of his mates went another way so they wouldn't disturb the meditating nun. And he took some of the meat, he wrapped it in a leaf, hung it on a tree, and made a loud noise. This is for whatever monk or nun wants to have it. And that was just as the nun was coming out of her meditation. So she heard that it was offered to her. So she took it and thought, no, I won't eat it myself. I'll take it to the Buddha. So she cooked it, and as she was in Rajagaha, and the Buddha was in Sarvati. And any of you who've been on pilgrimage, that's a full day's journey in a bus. But of course, she didn't need buses, because she was one of these enlightened nuns with psychic powers who actually flew there. And she just got to the Jeta Grove, but the Buddha was out on arms round, so she gave it to one of the other monks to offer to the Buddha. And that was actually one very clear case of the Buddha eating meat. So you don't go to hell if you eat meat. You go to hell, you know, if you feel guilty about what you've done. You go to hell if you got this very bad mind state which tells your relations you're going to go to hell if you eat meat. That sort of mind state is the sort of one which you go to hell. So you don't sort of criticize other people. You don't scare other people. That's just empty fear. How did the monks of the Thai tradition go about this? Please share insight with us. Because Ajahn Chah ate meat as well, and fish. That was just all you could eat. Nothing else allowed. Ajahn Brahm, if one feels that the mind is at peace and yet it doesn't settle into meditation, is it because the mind is probably not truly at peace? Are there any other reasons the mind races off following inconsequential, trivial thoughts? If the mind is following thoughts, it's not at peace. So, you know, you can't sort of bend the meaning of peace. If you're peaceful, there's no noise in your mind. It's silent. There's no going backwards and forwards. It's still. There's no agitation. There's no waves on the surface. That's what peace really means. So it's not as if you say, if you feel the mind is at peace and yet it doesn't settle. If it doesn't settle, your mind is not at peace. So just make peace and then you have peace. You said you'd always do something you're interested in and would help others. Did I? I don't remember what I said. I talk so much. I must have said everything. It's going to be said. You said you would always do something you are interested in and would help others. Oh no, what I said was those were when I decided what I was going to do in life. I would always do things which would give me satisfaction and happiness. That was important. The other thing, where I could help others. So I wanted to do those two things. Something which, you know, fulfilled my own happiness, Because we all want to be happy, and that was important to me, but I also wanted to be of service to others. What would you have done if you didn't become a monk? I'd probably become a rock star. Because that way I could help others. No, you wouldn't. You just... And the other thing, actually, people think I would have become is like a stand-up comedian. Because that would make me happy, because I'm just laughing all the time. And I could actually get into telling jokes to other people. So I think that's probably what I would have done if I hadn't become a monk. And as many of you know, I've told you that once when I was in Melbourne, I was actually offered a job as a stand-up comedian in the Melbourne Comedy Club. And for those of you who know Australia, the Melbourne Comedy Club, you know, is the place where, you know, the many professional comedians in Australia start out. And it's got a really great reputation. That's the sort of the ground where stand-up comedians come from, the Melbourne Comedy Club. And I was actually offered a job there when I was a monk. I said, no, I'll keep my day job. How do the monks train in not getting ego and sense of self and being a monastic? I met some pretty arrogant monastics thinking they're better than others because they have bald heads and wear rag robes. It's great being a monk in the West. Because in the West, if I get egotistical or anyone else gets egotistical, you tell me off. In Asia, you're not allowed or it's not done to criticize a monk. But over here, oh no, it's fun criticizing monks. You write questions like this. And so, you know, it's much healthier, you know, coming to the West. And this is why, you know, sometimes I think all of the monks who spend a year or two in Western countries like Australia. Because, you know, we won't respect a person just because they've got a bald head and, you know, rag robes. In fact, you know, usually you don't respect them because they've got robes on and bald heads. And you give them a much harder time. You know, why aren't you wearing proper clothes? Well, I know what happened that once when I was first came over here, this 14-year-old girl came out, I was loading up the car, you know, with building stuff to come over to the Bodhinyana Monastery, and this 14-year-old girl came out and looked at me with utter disgust. Yeah, yuck, you're dressed like a girl, that's sick, she said. And she was so disgusted, it was just so over the top, I just burst out laughing. But you know, she thought I was a deviant, you know, like a man dressed in a girl's skirt. And she said, that's really sick. So that's the respect I got when I first came here. So, you know, that's great to sort of knock you around. So, you know, you don't have any ego. So, and if you do, in Australia, people will let you know straight away. And I think that's very healthy. So look, please, for those of you who live in Asia, don't be afraid of criticizing monks. In the time of the Buddha, people would criticize monks. That's where all our rules came from in the Vinaya, because the lay people criticize the bad behavior of the monk. Somehow we think that we shouldn't do that these days. And you know what happens here in the Catholic Church when people would not criticize the priests? They got away with pedophilia. And why was that? Because people knew what was happening, but they didn't complain, or they didn't complain hard enough. It was a sin to complain about the priests. Be careful, never do that about Buddhist monks and nuns. Complain. And I say that as a Buddhist monk, because it keeps everything nice and pure. Otherwise, it's very easy to get a big ego. Look, you know, you stand up here and all these people are listening to you. It's very easy to get a big ego. And I remember this once. I went to give this one of the first big talks I gave in Singapore to about 3,000 people. I remember walking in and just in this huge auditorium, 3,000 or 4,000 people would wait to listen to a talk. And I thought to myself, the only way you can give a talk to so many people is if you've got no ego. If you've got the slightest bit of ego there, you'd be afraid. You'd be nervous. And I thought, this is really interesting. The less ego you have, the more people you can talk to. But when you've got a big ego, you know, you lose it. So sometimes it's a great test. That's why some monks are a bit nervous to give talks, because you're showing up yourself in public. People say that's the most scary thing to do, is to give a public talk. Why is that? Because of ego. You're afraid what people might think of you. That's for me. I'm not afraid at all what you think of me. Because that's why I can tell jokes, you know, because, you know, don't care what you think of the jokes. Sometimes you laugh, sometimes you groan. That's your problem, not mine. What's the difference between a scientist who intellectualized non-self and someone who experienced it? How does the experience make the process start towards nirvana? The thing with a scientist who intellectualized non-self is that I've seen all these scientists. That's one of the reasons why I left academia. And these great people who had this amazing sort of intelligence, they got depressed, they got divorced. I mean, they were, what I used to say at the time, intelligent in chemistry but stupid in life. So it's almost like compartmentalized thing. I remember going to these, I used to go to autopsies in Thailand, but the first years we were here, we managed to get into the autopsies at Sir Charles Garden Hospital. And I remember sort of the coroner there, not the coroner, I think the pathologist, head pathologist, I don't know, Dr. Hilton, he became sort of a bit notorious. He went to Sydney and did something wrong or something. But, you know, we asked him afterwards, you know, he's cutting up dead bodies all day. He said, how does this affect your life, you know, your life outside the autopsy room? And he told us he compartmentalizes. When he's actually cutting up a corpse, it's not a body, it's not a human being, it's something different. So, you know, when he sort of, you know, goes and makes love to his wife in the evening, it's a totally different perception, even though he doesn't make the connection between sort of his wife and the corpse which he works with every day. And that sort of compartmentalization, the separation, not joining the dots, I think is what happens with scientists. Because, you know, they don't want to see non-self. So in science, psychiatry, psychology, yeah, there's no self. But when it gets into their ordinary daily life, my goodness, there's a big self there. If you were going to psychology conferences, you probably know that. So that's the difference there. So a bit of compartmentalizing. On the surface, they know, but it doesn't go deep. During my meditation after lunch, I had two jerks initially. The one sitting to my left and one sitting to my right. I added that. I'm just messing around. That's not what the paper says. Now, during my meditation after lunch, I had two jerks initially, head, hands and upper part of the body. In a short time, my breath became very, very short. I could hear very little. During this state, I could hear clearly every background sound, but I did not become restless, unlike during the present moment. My breath remained like this until I finished my session, about 2 hours. I did not expect anything to happen, but I want to know whether I became peaceful. You know whether you're peaceful or not. So not me, but if you have some jerks, head, hands and upper part of the body, now it may be just the body just settling itself, getting rid of some tensions. But really it's just when you really get peaceful, you can't feel the body. And the body becomes perfectly still, it doesn't move at all. So if you're really getting peaceful, the body doesn't move, there's no jerks, nothing moves at all, and everything becomes really still. So that's real peace. So you can always make it more peaceful. But sometimes those jerks happens, and it just the body releasing some tension. If a householder develops a skill to hold nimitta extensively and go in and out of first jhana at will, how will this impact in his or her daily life, e.g. the way this person responds to his friends, the way he or she responds to intimacy, the way he responds to, what does it say? Buffet? Sorry? Comfort? Conflict. Okay. The conflict. Well, if you start to hold nimitta and get lots of first jhanas, this stuff is just, you're just not interested in all of this stuff. You know, if you just, if response to your friends, people will think you're not really paying too much attention to them. That, you know, you're not connecting with them, that you're in some other place. Because that's what happens when you get into deep jhanas. It's so peaceful and wonderful when people start talking about the cricket. What are you talking about? So what that your team win or lose? What's that got to do with things? You know, you start talking about sort of, you know, the sales in the shops and the dresses and the stuff you want to buy and think, well, so what? So, you know, you become sort of a little bit otherworldly. Which is why that, you know, if you are becoming otherworldly, it's better you live in another world. So in other words, if you get lots and lots of these things, you're liable to become a monk or a nun. Why is that? Because this is where you belong. you get lots and lots of nimittas and lots of jhanas, you really get into it, then, you know, there's just that world out there. There's, as the Buddha said, you know, your desires for those worldly things just vanishes. You're not interested anymore. So that's what happens. So response to conflict, you don't really have conflict. Just other people have conflict with you, but you don't conflict with them. So well, you can call me a pig, you can call me an idiot, but I've got my jhana. Who cares? You can do whatever, say whatever you want. Ah, okay.
Okay. So, I mean, that was what I was sort of wondering about.
Ah, okay.
You are much more connected and you've got a capacity to connect very deeply with people.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it might have something to do
with it. Okay, yeah. I see what you're getting at there. It is actually true in that sense that the jhanas or the nimittas or deep meditation takes away some of the fear. You know what happens with in an intimacy connected with a person? You know, a lot of people worry, what does he think of me? You know, when, you know, you're talking to someone, what does she think of me? And that means there's a barrier there, which you can't really connect very deeply. And when you have no idea of a sense of self, in other words, the jhanas, that's taken that a long way away. So when there's nothing in here, that's how you can connect. There's no barrier about, you know, self and me and how I'm coming across, whether I'm succeeding or failing. And all those little barriers which tense you up, which stop you really going deep into another person and connecting with them, they all disappear. So I think that's one of the reasons why you can have connections. But intimacy, I thought you meant sort of sexual intimacy. Okay.
Also conflict as well. I mean, you've had two big conflicts historically over the last 10 years. The first one was the clay pot stuff.
Oh, that one, yeah. The Bhikkhu Nisa, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, it's just all those. The clay trap was a long time ago, but the Bhikkhu Nisa one, you know, all these teachings which I give you guys, I practice those. Two bad bricks at a wall. So, you know, you're surrounded by the Japanese army. You sit down and have a cup of tea. I had lots of cups of tea. People call you a dog. So you look at your bottom, see if you've got a tail. Nothing there. So what's to worry about? I know one of the favourite ones, don't let other people control your happiness. So, do whatever you like. I'm going to still be happy. So those are some of the teachings which I remember. And I remember just even coming back from Wat Pa Pong just after I was expelled. And just looking at that, see what was going on in my head. And just I thought, wow, this is an excellent test to see, you know, whether all these teachings I give you guys, whether I can practice them myself. And it was actually not that hard. So he didn't get upset. It was an extra burden and thing to worry about. You had to write letters to people. That was just a pain, having to sort of do more things. But that was about it. So next question. Some people experience another consciousness come into their bodies. And these consciousnesses that come in are those of highly developed monks or beings who come to teach the way of awakening. Some of them are even beings like Anuruddha, whom it's said is able to communicate with Gautama Buddha. It is also said that the time to cultivate to become a Sammasambuddha Buddha is twice that to become an Arahat. Can you please comment on this? That's a bit weird. So another consciousness come into their bodies. It's very, very, very rare that any other consciousness can come into your body. And as far as a developed monk or a nun would never come into your body. So if that's what you really think, that's not real. That is just an imagination. And beings like Anuruddha, every Arahat has gone. That's why they call an Arahat. Their consciousness has ceased. There's no way they can communicate with you because as they're gone, there's nothing left. So, if anyone says they're able to communicate with Gautama Buddha, no way at all. The Buddha is gone. You can't sort of communicate with these beings. They're finished. They've done it. Nothing left. They're not sort of in some sort of heaven realm where they can come down and speak to you. They have ceased. Finished. Gone. The time to cultivate it becomes a Sammasambuddha is twice that to become an arahat. No, that's not said anywhere. So all a Buddha is the first arahat to come into existence after all the Dhamma has passed. So when there's no Dhamma left, then an arahat, you know, becomes an arahat and starts teaching. Because they're the first arahat, you know, in the season of teaching, they become the Buddha. That's all they are. So nowhere is it said that it takes twice or three times or 10 times or half the time to become a Sammasambuddha than an arahat. So I don't know where you got that stuff from, but that's weird. So I don't believe any of that. So that's what I say. You don't have to believe me. You can always argue. Because am I always right? There was this fellow once asked Ajahn Chah. He said, okay, now Ajahn Chah, you know, you're a great monk, you know, you're an arahat, you've got all these powers. Now, can you please tell me, does rebirth exist? Is there reincarnation? And Ajahn Chah replied, said, look, if I told you, would you believe me? And before the man could answer, he said, look, people just believe others just because they say it. They're stupid. And so he said, okay, I won't believe you. And he said, well, I'm not going to tell you then. That's actually a wonderful interchange, because just because I say it or the Buddha says it, does he have to believe it? I'm not the Pope. So even if what the Buddha says is actually true, by the time you hear it and it goes filtered through your perception, sometimes what was actually said is totally different than what you hear. You know, psychologists, you know that. So sometimes you can't even believe what you actually perceive. It's not what I said, it's what you heard. So that's why it's best not to believe anything from a master. Take it as a guide, but you find out for yourself. Buddhas don't tell you the truth, they just point you to the way. I think inner speech is quite useful for me. As I silently said peace in my mind, you can't silently say peace. You either said peace or you're silent, not both. You see what I mean about how we bend things to suit ourselves? I think inner speech is quite useful for me. As I silently said peace, I mean, what I think you said, you just very gently said peace. In my mind, I really felt peace and joy, sometimes even tears drop, felt rapture. How? Is it okay for such inner speech? I thought we have to let go of it in the next stage of meditation. You could just say a few little words to yourself, but not too much. For example, suppose when you leave here, you have to go to the airport. So you order a taxi. And as you get into the taxi outside the kitchen, having loaded all your luggage in the back, you tell the taxi, now look, I want to go to Perth Airport. You know, the international terminal, not the domestic terminal. I'm flying a Singapore Airlines. So just the first entrance, you know, as you go there. Now look, I've just been on a meditation retreat, so I don't want you to drive so fast. And please turn off your radio and don't talk to me because I'm silent. And because I'm a Buddhist, now, if a car wants to come in front of us or turn in, please let them turn in because I'm compassionate. I want you to be compassionate. I'm paying you, so this is how you should do this. And actually, by the way, I'll be sitting in the back. I might be meditating sometimes. So please don't drive too fast and put the brake on, because if you do, that will disturb my meditation. But I've just come off a meditation retreat. And I also want you to make sure that, you know, you don't turn very quickly, because I might slide off when I'm meditating. And please don't make too much noises. And please don't, stop at the traffic lights too quickly. If it's a yellow traffic light, look, you should stop. I don't want you just to run the lights just because you get there faster, because that's dangerous, and I'm compassionate. I don't want to cause a crash, so please drive carefully. And you haven't reached the gate yet, and the taxi driver will throw you out. He said, listen, madam, I know how to get to the airport. You just sit in the back and shut up. Now that simile is the way that many people meditate. close your eyes. Now, come on, you've got to be still. You've got to watch the breath. And don't make too much noise. Present moment awareness and be silent. But don't be too fierce. You've got to be gentle. Because Ajahn Brahm said, you mustn't make sort of fight the meditation. And you've got to make peace. And this is how you make peace. And if you get a nimitta, you mustn't sort of grasp onto it. You mustn't expect it. Remember not to expect anything. And when you're meditating, if it doesn't happen, no judging. So who cares anyway? Make peace. You get the message. That's why your mind throws you out. It doesn't want to have anything to do with you and goes thinking about all sorts of stupid things. Anything to get away from you. So with a sit, now many people do that, you know. They're always giving orders in their meditation. No wonder your mind doesn't cooperate. If you're getting in a taxi, all you need to do is just tell that taxi driver, take me to Perth International Airport. All the taxi drivers know how to get there. And you can sit down and shut up and be peaceful. How the taxi driver wants to get you there, that's their problem. They want to speed, they want to go slow, whatever they want to do, that's their problem. So just tell them, Perth Airport please, and then you can shut up. That's all you need to do with your mind. Just make peace. Give it some clear instructions, and then shut up and give the mind a chance. It knows what to do. The thing is, you never get a better chance. So, sell it. Make peace. And then give it a chance to take you to peace. How it takes you there is your mind's job. Just give it clear instructions and let it go. Meditation is so easy and wonderful with your instructions. Yes, I agree. I love meditating thanks to your teachings. Sadhu, this looks like my handwriting. No, it's not. It's other people's handwriting. And thank you, I deserve that. Do you feel like you would like more time out to hide in your cave, dear Ajahn? 15 days each year doesn't sound like very much to me, and you do work very hard, so you definitely deserve it. Yeah, okay. So, this retreat is now finished, and I'm going back into my cave. No, the Buddha said, actually, the real cave is called the cave of the heart, the Hadiya Guha. And when I came across that quote in part, I thought, it's really beautiful. What is the cave of the heart? In deep meditation. Because deep in meditation, it's just like being in a cave. You can hear no sounds. Everything is dark. It's cool. You can't feel the body. You're gone. So that's the real cave of the heart. The real cave is jhana. Dear Ajahn, I'm trying to understand what dreams are. Well, you've got plenty of time to do that here. The amount of time many of you have been sleeping, you should be experts on dreams by now. You know, practice makes perfect, as they say. About 10% of dreams I can remember. How do you know 10%? Because you don't know the other 90%, you can't remember them. So how come you say 10%? About 10% of dreams I can remember. About 10% of dreams I can remember become true. Now that's really interesting. So your dreams actually become true. So look, if that person can please tell us the lottery number for next week. Because, you know, we have to raise money for our nuns' monastery, building big rooms over there. So, you know, it's 10%. So that's actually pretty good, 10%. So you have 10 of your dreams, and then one of those lottery numbers must win. Is there any connection between mental condition and dreams? Can you help me? Okay. It's usually the dreams are usually the sign that you're sleeping too much. It's true, I mean, because it is, because your brain is working and your body is still lying down. So usually most dreams apparently happen just before you wake up. The ones you remember, because basically you should have woken up. So your brain wants to wake up, so it's active, but your body is still sort of laying down. You're in a bit of a stupor. So, and the 10% of dreams you can remember become true. I think that, look, that's just probably coincidence. You know, your dreams, all sorts of dreams, and it's only afterwards that they come true that you remember, oh, I dreamt about that. So, but was it really a prediction or not? I think if it really was a prediction, you can make a fortune. But I tell people that, you know, somebody told me today they were not thinking whether they should buy a house here or buy a house there. I said, oh, just toss a coin up, just make your decision. Say, no, I'm going to see a fortune teller. I tell you, if you're going to go and see a fortune teller, make sure they're a very, very, very rich and wealthy fortune teller. Because if they can't tell their own fortune, what hope have they to tell yours? So I don't believe fortune tellers. Because all the fortune tellers I see are poor. If they're fortune tellers, why can't they tell their own fortune? But they can't. That's why I don't believe fortune tellers. And anything else which you dream about. When was the last time I told you about that's Singapore tweet about the five angels? Yeah, this is actually what happens in dreams. This is an amazing story. Here in Perth some years ago, this guy had a dream. You know, again, just before you wake up, that's when you get these dreams. He dreamt of five angels. Now, you know, real angels in his dream. He was so impressed. But every one of those angels had five pots of gold. And they came up to him, one after another, to present him with this fortune in gold. You know how much gold is worth these days? And he picked up the last pot of gold, the 25th, and then he woke up. And he looked around his room, he couldn't see any angels at all. But that didn't worry him. What worried him, there was no pots of gold in his bedroom. He realized it was a dream, but it was a very vivid dream. So he remembered that after he got showered and washed and dressed, he went down to have breakfast. And he couldn't believe that that morning his wife had made him five boiled eggs and five pieces of toast for breakfast. And five angels, five pots of gold, five boiled eggs, five pieces of toast. What's with this number five? So when he picked up the morning newspaper, the West Australian, he noticed the date, 5th of May, the fifth day of the fifth month. And he thought this was like somebody trying to tell him something important, like an omen. So, what did he do? He looked in the racing section of the newspaper. Here in Perth is a racetrack called Ascot. It's named after the English racetrack. He realized, A-S-C-O-T. Five letters. So straight away he looked in race number five that day. He looked down horse number five. He couldn't believe his eyes. In that day, horse number five on race number five was called Five Angels. That's amazing. He realized that, you know, some spirit was giving him a very strong hint. So what do? You only get these omens maybe once in a lifetime, if you're lucky. So what did he do? He took the afternoon off work. He never told his wife. Because sometimes these women don't understand these things. He went to the bank at lunchtime. He had to keep the lucky number five. So he took $5,000 out of his account. If you're going to do this, you've got to do it big. You only get one chance in a lifetime. So he took $5,000 out of his bank account. He went to the racetrack. He went to the fifth bookmaker, the fifth bookie in line, to keep the lucky number five and put $5,000 to win. Horse number five, race number five, five angels. The lucky number five couldn't be wrong. And it wasn't wrong. His horse came in fifth. That's an old joke, but it's a very good joke. Because it shows you all these dreams that, yeah, they've got a meaning, but you don't really understand the meaning. He was telling him his horse is going to come in fifth, lucky number five, okay? So don't trust those dreams. Thank you very much for an illuminating talk on jhana this morning. I hope one moment in the future I may be able to experience it so I know for myself and not just know it because you say so. I agree. I cannot understand why some teachers discourage experienced jhanas quite vehemently. Please shed some light on this, because they have never experienced jhanas. It's very embarrassing sometimes if you're a teacher and you haven't experienced what, you know, the Buddha was talking about. So jhanas aren't necessary. What they're saying is they haven't achieved those jhanas. As the mind is getting quiet, beautiful purple arises. The mind is not yet completely with the breath. It is very enjoyable. Great, enjoy it. So this is what happens. Sometimes the mind is getting quiet. It's not completely with the breath yet. You may be able to hear something, but nimittas are starting to arise. Great, so just make the mind a little bit more peaceful. And the light gets more peaceful and more beautiful. Doesn't matter whether it's purple or red or whatever colour it is. You know, the colour, you add the colour. So everyone sees the same in nimittas. Amazing insight to have that. You know, what you're seeing is exactly the same, but you add the colour. Basically, you paint it purple or white or yellow, whatever colour you expect it to be. So there's nothing important about what colour you see. Purple is very, very common. Gold, white, they're all common colours. Here we go. Cheese, yogurt and milk are from the same source, but why cheese and dark chocolate are allowable in the afternoon but not the other? I think there is the reason and would like to learn. Please teach us or explain about this. Thank you. There is no reason. Basically. At least I haven't found it after 36 years as a monk. Cheese is allowable, but milk isn't allowable. Yogurt isn't allowable. And of course, cow isn't allowable. It all came from the same source. The Christians have Christmas, so why don't the Buddhists have Buddhamas instead? Oh, no. Actually, we do have Buddhamas. Because, look, I said this, I mean, people think I'm joking here, but there's actually something to this. When is Christmas Day? 25th of December. And that's a very cold day, even over in sort of Palestine, where Jesus was supposed to have been born. And anybody who's ever been to Israel, no shepherds would be out on that December, you know, and that's when Jesus was supposed to be born. So it's quite clear that Jesus would not be born on December the 25th. In fact, December the 25th became Christmas Day, the birth of Jesus, only in the Roman Empire. It used to be the day for celebrating the god Mithras. It was Mithras Day. In Rome. And when Christianity became the religion of the Romans, they took the celebration from Mithras and they made it Christmas Day. So December the 25th, historically, was Mithras Day. Or Mithra's Day. But no one really knows this cult of Mithra. We know now actually that some of that has actually passed on into Christianity. Because the bishops, what's the hat called? The Mitra. And that actually comes from Mithras. That's the one thing which they keep from that sort of ancient Roman religion. And Mithras was supposed to be some sort of bull. Now, Mitra, what does that word remind you of? Friend, or Mitra, Maitra. Maitra. Maitreya. So I reckon that was Maitreya Day, because the four animals which the Buddha described himself as was a thoroughbred horse, was a Naga elephant, was the bull, the Usaba, what was the other one? It was the lion with the lion's roar. And if you go to India, you often actually see those four animals like on Asoka's column. So I reckon December the 25th was Maitreya Day. So it was a Buddhist holiday. So the next 25th, December the 25th, don't send Christmas cards. Say Maitreya cards. Happy Maitreya Day. So that's, Christians have Christmas, Buddhists have Maitreya Day. No, we have Blissmas. Blissmas, that's what we've got now. That's a very good, Blissmas. Happy Blissmas Day. Then when the Christians realize that is a year-round event and not just one day a year, they will all convert to Buddhism. That's a very good question. I read that out totally because that's worthwhile reading out. The Christians have Christmas, so why don't we Buddhists have Christmas instead? Then when the Christians realize that it is a year-round event and not just one day a year, they will all convert to Buddhism. But imagine the government giving us 365 days of holiday a year. Gee, that's a bit tough one. They won't even give us Waisak Day. Can one achieve enlightenment by solely meditating, or is it a total package of meditation, seeing the Dhamma, doing good, and please elaborate? There's only one way to get enlightened. What is the only way to enlightenment? Yeah. Say it louder. Eightfold path. Yeah. Once more. Eightfold path. Yeah. That's the only way to enlightenment. So it includes samadhi, but not just meditation. You have to keep your precepts as well. So you can't just sit meditation and have a mistress on the side and think you're going to get enlightened. You can't just sit meditation and just get drunk or take drugs and think your meditation or samadhi is so strong you won't get drunk. You've got to actually have the whole package of Eightfold Path. And look, and the Buddha was such a compassionate being. If any one of those factors wasn't necessary, he would have taken it off the list to make life easier for you. So it's Eightfold Path, you need all eight of those, otherwise you can't get enlightened. Sorry, not a question on meditation, but rather concern about one of our animals here at China Grove. I had noticed a happy family of kangaroos bouncing along the bottom of our block yesterday afternoon. One baby, a mother and a father. However, the father had a broken left arm that swung like a pendulum as he hopped along. This would have to be very painful, maybe not, I don't know. Not sure if anything can be done, thought I'd just mention it. Talk about a path with no groans. This is one Buddhist kangaroo. Okay, that sometimes that I think usually those males, it's not a family. Because that male, if it's a male over there, it's after the female. Because this time of the year they have babies, but there's also the times when the males are looking to impregnate, sort of the females as well. So one male has many, many mistresses, kangaroos. So it's not a family. The guy is after hanky-panky. And usually the reason why they have a broken arm is because the male kangaroos fight sometimes to the death. Because there's only one kangaroo for many, many females. So it's almost certainly been in a fight. And that's why he's got the broken arm. It's very difficult to know what to do there, because we did have, remember, there was one kangaroo we found whose arm had been shot. And we took it to the vet, and the only thing they could do was amputate the arm. But the kangaroo died of infection afterwards. So it's very, very difficult to know. Even to catch the male kangaroo is difficult to begin with. And actually, to do something about it, you don't know whether you're helping or harming. So sometimes in nature like that, all you can do is just to give metta. And animals deal with it in their own way. So it's obviously, you know, it's limping, but it's probably just, you know, accommodated to that situation. So that's basically all you can do. And again, the head isn't all that important for the kangaroos. You know, sometimes they use it to move forward, but it's not that important to part of its anatomy. Except the kangaroos at Bodhinyana Monastery, they need both hands, because when they pick up a pizza, they need both hands to eat it. It's amazing seeing these kangaroos eating junk food over the road in the monastery. It's really, really funny. The first time when we remember putting food out for the kangaroos, and I saw it eating spaghetti. Because, you know, we had extra spaghetti, we put it out there, and just the kangaroos got into it. They loved it. But, you know, just like the first time you take spaghetti, you don't know how to eat it. So it had this spaghetti drooping from its mouth. And it was looking at us and saying, well, what do I do next? How can you eat this stuff? It managed. And the other time I used to put out some remains from my meal when I used to be on retreat to the kangaroos. And I used to thought, you know, I want to look after the kangaroos. I put some carrots and some lettuce and an apple out there for the carrot. And I thought, for the kangaroo, I thought that's what they would eat. And I saw this kangaroo push aside the carrot, push aside the apple, push aside the salad, and go straight for the pizza. And this is where you actually find it. People in monastery, you know this, that kangaroos, they love junk food. They love pizza. And it's the only kangaroos in the whole of Australia probably who get pizza over in Bodhinyana Monastery. That's why they keep hanging around. That's why they like us. After lunch, I was falling asleep. I noticed my attention was on the breath. Is falling asleep the same as letting go process? Oh, wish it was. Then you'd be an arahant already, the number of times you fall asleep. When I noticed the attention away on the breath, was on the breath, I woke up. Very good. And sometimes after a meal you get a bit sleepy, but after, you know, you start to focus, you can wake up. So it's very, very good. But falling asleep is not sort of the same as letting go, because you're letting go of the wrong thing. You're letting go of your awareness. So, but sometimes you need to sleep, so just take it easy. And if you wake up, then you watch the breath, and it's nice and easy, then wonderful, you've just slept enough. Thank you for the talk this morning. You've explained the three jhanas. Could you kindly please explain what goes on for the fourth jhana, neither happiness nor non-happiness? Okay, I'll explain fourth jhana when you've got one of those jhanas. So why do we always want to know so much? We haven't got first jhana yet. We want to know what fourth jhana is. Fourth jhana is when you're just so still and peaceful and nothing's happening at all. It's a different type of pleasure, the pleasure when you're perfectly at peace. Because peace is the highest happiness, even more so than happiness. So you get really weird states where each of these jhanas is a different type of happiness. And this is not ordinary happiness, it's the happiness of deep, 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 deep peace. Nothing is moving, so still. Ajahn, please explain, how does the mind of a dying patient work when that patient is highly sedated, almost unconscious and pain-free? I told this story to someone earlier today about, it was in Time magazine, from a doctor in the United States whose patient had a brain tumour. And the brain tumour, this is the first time I understood about brain tumours, I thought the tumour would grow and actually squash the rest of the brain. But it doesn't work that way, actually the tumour colonises the brain cells. So basically the tumour takes up more of the brain cells and you've got less brain cells for the rest of your body and mind. So the prognosis of a malignant tumour in the brain is very, very clear. It keeps up colonising more of your brain, so you start to lose your memory. You start to lose your ability to speak. And then you start to lose the other bodily functions until there's hardly any brain left to work the body, and so you stop breathing because the brain is no longer able to give the orders. So it was a long process over many weeks of slow deterioration, losing the ability to remember to speak, and then losing the bodily functions, until last of all you would not be able to breathe. And you could pretty much time it. You could see how the tumor was progressing. So it was coming to the last few hours of this man's life. So all the family were around the bedside. It was only a matter of minutes or hours to go. And then the patient opened his eyes, leant upwards, and had a beautiful conversation with all his family for 15 minutes, and then fell down and died. At that time, he had no brain left, but he could speak intelligently, lovingly, and say his last words. Isn't that nice? I remember two of our members, one of the members in Dhammaloka Center. They were with their father, two sisters. I think one sister comes, the other one doesn't come to Dhammaloka, to our city centre in Dolamara, and they were sitting on either side of the bed holding their father's hand as he was dying. And they were just holding it there. You know what it's like if you've been with people dying, you don't know when it's going to happen, you're just there hour after hour. Sometimes they go breathing and they stop breathing. And then they start again. And you know, many, many times you think they've gone, but they're not, they start again. And then they were just waiting. And then suddenly their father's eyes opened. He leaned up, looked at both of his daughters, and in perfect synchronicity, they didn't plan this, they both said, "We love you, Dad." And then he closed his eyes and died. And now this is common. Even under sedation, the last few moments become very clear. as if this is where the mind separates from the body and the brain. So it doesn't work with the brain anymore. It works separately from the brain, which allowed that man to talk for 15 minutes to his family. That was an extreme case. In the case which I know from here, it allowed this man to open his eyes and be clear just for a minute, enough for his two daughters to say the last words to their dad, "I love you, Dad." And then he died. And they thought that was just so beautiful, they had the chance to tell him. And he was aware at that time. The brain had stopped, but the mind was awake. And that's what happens when you die. You may be very sedated, but the last few moments are clear. You wake up. Because the mind separates from the brain. Do you understand that? Have you had any experience of that? You have. There we go. Yeah. Okay, just one of the meditators here said his niece had an aneurysm, and on the way to hospital she was out of it, and suddenly she woke up to say she loved whoever was in the hospital, in the ambulance, and they said they loved her, and then she fell away, and by the time she was in the hospital she was dead. Probably the same. It happens. Venerable Sir, when the hall lights are switched on prior to the chanting, could the entire hall be illuminated, please, so that we non-felines sitting in the rear can read our scripts? Felines. Yeah, okay, so we put all the lights on this tonight. But it's a great thing, because when you sort of, the two times when we meditate, all the lights come on, and it reminds you of nimittas. So this is just practice, this is what it's like. You got your eyes closed and you ring the gong and all these lights come on. That's what it's like. So one day it will happen. All the lights come on, you think, oh, it's time for chanting. And it's not. The nimittas have happened. Last question. Can you please talk a bit about the person who killed a lot of people, then became enlightened at the time of the Buddha? That was Angulimala. He was serial killer. He killed 999, which is a lot. Most people think it was probably only 99. But it was still a lot of people. And he cut off their fingers. And he wore them around his neck. That was grisly and gruesome. And probably very smelly. And of course, he tried to kill the Buddha. And the Buddha would always run faster than him. And Angulimala shouted out of the Buddha, "Stop!" And the Buddha said, "I've stopped, you stop." And many people think that meant stop breaking the precepts, but it meant much more than that. It meant stop moving your mind. Just like that little novice, stop. And he got into jhanas and got very, very deep. That's a beautiful story, because it was a stop, which was the Dhamma taught by the Buddha to Angulimala. Very simple word, but incredibly profound. So, you can tell that to yourself tonight. Stop. And see if you stop. And if you do, when you wake up, it'll be time for the morning chanting. You sat here all night. Wow, that's cool. It also means, once you understand that great teaching, you understand how far Buddhism has come into Australia. Because at every crossroads we have the great lights telling you, stop. Every time you're driving a car, you've got an opportunity to become enlightened. With the red traffic lights, stop. And also the stop signs. We've got one in front of the gate. If you noticed it, one side says slow down, the other one says stop. It was left here by the builder, but we thought that's a great sign at the entrance to Jhana Grove. Slow down and stop. So, those are the questions, all new ones this evening. So thank you for those questions. And some of them, there's lots of them. So some of them you can't answer so deep. Some you make a bit of fun in games with. So I hope I don't offend anybody. But if I do, tough luck. Because it's all your fault. I take no responsibility. So thank you for listening to the questions and answers. Another talk tomorrow morning, and who knows what that talk might be. So wait and see. And it's exciting. If you knew what the talk would be, life wouldn't be interesting. So who knows what's coming next. But for you, I know what's coming next. Your pillow. So please have a nice night. See you in the morning. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good.